everybody. I'm Karen Hutt-Glass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Here we are. It's August 13th, 2013. And what I love about today here in New York City is it's a rainy day. It's not raining right at the moment, but what's really nice about these summer rainy days, I find, is that they're quiet. I live in an urban area right next to a playground, and although it's nice to see the kids having fun, screaming, laughing, whatever, making a lot of noise, when it rains, everything all of a sudden gets so peaceful, and I really appreciate the contrast. So today is one of those nice days. And it's always good to find something good about rain, right? Some people call it liquid sunshine. I just think it's a good time to be peaceful. Okay, let's bring on the first guest today, Ruby Roth. This is her third time on It's All About Food, and she has a new book out, V is for Vegan, The ABCs of Being Kind. She's an acclaimed activist, artist, former teacher, and author whose children's books have been featured in The San Francisco Chronicle, The Huffington Post, The Washington Times, Change.org, Glamour, and Wired, as well as on The Today Show, Fox, ABC, CNN, and other major media outlets. She first discovered children's interest in veganism while teaching at an elementary school teaching art. Complementing her degrees in art and American studies, she has researched animal agriculture, health, nutrition, and the benefits of a plant-based diet for nearly a decade. Her first book, That's Why We Don't Eat Animals, was published in 2009, a vegan since 2003. She lives in Los Angeles. Hi, Ruby. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm so happy to be back with you.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here, too. I know we're having some cyberspace challenges here, and I hope that we don't have any during this hour, because that wouldn't be fun. But let's just press on. So one of the reasons why I like having you on the show, and this is not one of the important reasons, but I always read the books of authors I talk to, and yours are very easy to read.
Yeah, I always say so easy even adults can understand them.
But that gives you time to enjoy the pictures and kind of ponder the concepts. All right, so you write children's books, and they're not your average everyday children's book. There's a special message in here, and I think it's a really important message, and yet I'm sure you get a lot of controversy behind these books.
Sure. Well, they are the first vegan and vegetarian books for children that address factory farming and the environment and the emotional lives of animals, how food affects the whole world. And yes, they have definitely ruffled some feathers, industry feathers, but they definitely are finding the people that they were meant for, and this population of vegans and vegetarians is just growing exponentially in the past few years.
Are there any other children's books that talk about factory farming?
Not that I know of. I've never been able to find one, and that's how my books came about, because I was searching for one to share with my students who were really curious about my eating habits, and I couldn't find one. Everything that I found was about a talking animal or a talking vegetable, and I just knew these kids weren't going to relate to that, and that's not how I spoke to them, you know, in this sugar-coated voice. So that's how these books came about.
Right. Well, I want to talk a lot more about that. I just pulled up Goodreads a little while ago and Googled or searched on vegetarian and vegan books for kids, and this list of 77 came up, and yours was number 2, and the first one was, The Lorax by Dr. Seuss. Hello? Okay, let's see what happened here. I think we need to get Ruby back. And the question is, shall I continue? Okay, well, I'm looking at this list here on Goodreads, and The Lorax is the first book. Oh, you here, Ruby?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. I lost you.
back.
Yeah, you know, it's the rain. I'm sure it's the rain. I love the rain, as I was saying before, but, you know, sometimes, even though in this high-tech world, all those ions and things out there can wreak havoc at a nano level.
Well, we can't be mad at the rain.
No, we can't. I love the rain. Anyway, so I was saying, and I'll say it again, I'm looking at this list of vegetarian, vegan-friendly books for kids, and the number one book here is Lorax by Dr. Seuss. Great book. But the next one is yours. That's why we don't eat animals. Right here, number two.
Good, because I feel like by sugarcoating and avoiding speaking to kids directly about what's at stake with animals and the environment, I think we are just putting off what we should be learning as young people.
Okay, here's the crazy thing.
Yeah.
There's so much violence out there.
Yeah.
And there's so much violence in children's media today.
Yeah.
Everywhere. So why is it okay to have all kinds of shoot 'em up kind of videos, all
mm-hmm.
kinds of superheroes out there saving the world against evil, so many different dark concepts, and yet we cannot expose the darkness in what's really going on?
Well, I think because those video games don't push us to make any changes with ourselves, and I think change can be very scary for people, and especially when we've been born and raised and bred to think that the standard American diet is endorsed by doctors and all the healthcare practitioners in the world, and that that's totally normal. It's a real shock to a lot of people to realize that they've been a tool in someone else's game, and that we haven't actually made a conscientious choice about our foods most of the time. So the other part of that is that veganism is still pretty new to the mainstream, and I think a lot of people think that veganism is the standard American diet minus meat and dairy, which leaves nothing upon nothing. The fact is that people throughout history and cultures throughout history have practiced plant-based diets and thrived, and we have our own pyramid, per se, and everything we need in it.
One thing that I really believe in is telling the truth, being honest, and also empowering our youth with the truth, but also showing them as adults that we're doing what we can and we expect them to do the same, that we're working to make this world a better place. It will be their responsibility to make this world a better place, and they need to know what the issues are so
yes.
that they can work towards those things.
Yes, I think that a big issue in school and at home with parents is that we often tell kids, you can change the world, you can be anything you want to be, and we don't give them any solid foundation of what either of those things actually means. So I believe we really have to discuss the motives and what's at stake, and I think that kids are totally open and capable of understanding. My experience in the classroom proves it. They are not only eager to learn why someone wouldn't eat animals because they love animals, but they're eager to take part in something that creates solutions.
Absolutely. This isn't exactly the same subject, but I was raised with honesty. My parents always let us know what was going on, the good things, the bad things. If there were money issues during difficult periods, you know, we were aware of those things. There was nothing that was discussed in hushed tones that the children shouldn't hear. And I think that's really important because kids perceive everything. And when you're keeping secrets, that just develops distrust and fear. So I really commend you for being honest in your books.
Yeah, and I think that kind of education lasts a lifetime, no matter where you apply it. You know, this building of critical thinking and questioning, that lasts through a child's life in their professions and in their family life. There's a much bigger, broader spectrum of benefits than just the practical aspects of health and animals to this lifestyle.
I don't have children. I don't know what the books are that they're reading today. All I remember is good old Dick and Jane and Spot. But I have a feeling that some things have not changed, and I have a feeling that some of those idyllic images of animals and farms are probably still the same.
Sure, and not only do they have they lasted throughout the years, but the meat and dairy industries know that they must reach children in order to maintain their status quo in the marketplace. And one of the responses to my books coming out, I've heard in trade magazines that, you know, they want to come out with their own books targeted at school children to make sure that kids are normal, that meat and dairy are normalized with children. So it's active and it's intentional and it's organized.
Well, one of the problems is money, and schools, many schools don't have enough, and so they accept free materials, and they get a lot of free materials from these big ag food companies that want to promote their products, and they do it in a very covert way, mm-hmm. almost. And so I'm imagining if they do create these children's books, it's only going to make things worse.
Yeah, and those will get right into the schools for
yep.
that reason.
I was at the Book Expo in New York a few months ago, and one of the great things about being at a Book Expo is that there are so many free books that
yeah.
you can get. And it was my first time, and a friend of mine said, you absolutely must bring a suitcase, a wheelie.
Yes.
And I thought, okay, this is a great opportunity for me to collect children's books because I have a young niece and nephew, and I thought I'll get a whole pile of books for them because they love to read. And I grabbed a lot of books, and before presenting them to them, I ended up not presenting them with any of them because all of them had something in it that I found offensive.
Mm.
Either it was violent, promoted some sort of violence, promoted some sort of darkness, or had the kids eating the foods that I don't think kids should be eating.
Mm-hmm.
It was really hard.
Well, I think it's interesting to use those materials anyway and then have a discussion around them,
mm-hmm.
kind of like what your parents did with you, how you were saying they included you. And I think that way they are not only... You are exposing them to this other side, but they're going to be exposed to all of these issues as they grow up. And this way they're getting an opportunity to think critically and maybe to read between the lines of messages that are directed at them. And I think that makes a difference, you know, when you go to the grocery store even and you're shopping with your kid, to point out why those all the junk food and the candy and the cereals are on the low shelves where they're at kids' eyeballs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that those are placed there by companies to trick you into wanting it, you know, and then kids start to wrap their brains around this kind of game that is played in the marketplace that they play a role in.
So in other words, teach your children critical thinking at an early age.
Yeah, I think we shouldn't avoid difficult issues or topics,
mm-hmm.
but rather invite them and use them to teach our children.
I like that. I mean, I'm still trying to teach some of the adults that I'm around some of these issues. Like, look at what you're being marketed to buy. Think about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, my newest book, Views for Vegan, is only 26 sentences long, so it will be the shortest read yet to distribute.
Let's, I wanted to talk about a few of those sentences. I is for insects, not happy in jars. That brought back so many images to me. I remember as a kid, unfortunately, I wasn't too supervised, and I think it's good that children have a certain amount of freedom, but I used to play a lot
mm-hmm.
in the backyard and my friends' backyards, and we did horrible things to insects. I mean, I would take the alcohol out, I would dissect them, and I'm really sorry I did all of those things. But kids are encouraged to collect insects in jars.
It's true, and I think that even before they're encouraged, they are really interested in this animal. And it's so common. You know, one of my last book signings, this little boy came and he had a moth in this box.
Mm-hmm.
So excited to show me And actually, Rory Friedman of Skinny Bitch was there, too, and we both saw it. And Rory kind of explained to him that the moth might be happier if we let it go, and it looked like it needed to be let go. And I think he got it.
Right. I was recently at a young child's birthday party, and one of the gifts he was given was a jar to look at insects in. It was actually a toy that was packaged that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we take, just like I was saying before, we take that interest and we make them think critically about it, that this is an animal that wants to breathe and live and be in nature where it's supposed to be. And I think an education like that from childhood, just that normalizing of empathy and thinking from someone else's point of view will make a big difference later on.
I don't make a big issue about honey, but in your book you have H. H is for honey. That's food for bees. Bees need their honey when temperatures freeze. And that was actually something that I didn't really think about. I don't eat honey, but when people ask me, you know, do you eat honey? And I always say, you know, let's talk about the big picture here. We've got 60 billion land animals every year being killed for food, and I don't want to focus on that. But they need their, what happens there with honey in the wintertime?
Well, because the bees are pollinating during the summers and the springs, and when it's not icy cold out, they take the food that they make, the honey, and they store it. And it's not only used for food, but to insulate the hive so that they don't freeze to death. And I made this issue more about the bees than, you know, there's a lot of people who feel that honey is really good for you, and maybe there's some vegans who are vegans, they call themselves,
right,
who eat honey but no other animal product. And in any case, I think the bee, the colony death crisis that we're having all over the world is a real issue that everybody needs to be aware of. And then bees need our special protection at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, clearly we're doing a lot of bad things, and it's like the canary in the mine, the bee. We're going to see this, I think, more and more with different species, but the more we put toxic chemicals out into our world, into what we're growing, and the little animals that are feeding on those things are going to be negatively impacted faster than we are.
Yes, and the bee death is definitely a measure of what we've done, the mistakes we've made, and I think it's time to turn it around.
And I was going to say it's funny, but it's not funny. They are impacted in more ways than one with our mistakes, so not just the toxic herbicides and pesticides, but we feed them very often in these big bee compounds. We take away the honey and we put in high fructose corn syrup.
Right.
Another bad thing, and I think the total effect is what's getting them.
Yeah, I always tell people anytime you're exchanging money for animal products, their best interests are not at stake at all. So when you really look into bee farming and how the queens have to be artificially inseminated even, and it's just such a strange process.
Who thinks of these things?
It's crazy. It's just crazy. So why don't we just let the bees do what they're going to do?
Right. So there's, I'm just thumbing through this lovely little book that was enjoyable and easy to read. so important. There's K is for kitchen. Let's help cook and clean. It doesn't take much to really get to the point. Two very critical things, cooking and cleaning, both so important.
Yeah, I think we just have to invite our kids into the kitchen, make cooking and food and the collecting of food really enjoyable and social, and just make it a happy part of your family. Don't make it worrisome and, you know, a bunch of rules. But this is a joy in my life and in our family's life, and I think that's how you get kids interested in it. That's how kids are interested in other countries like France, for example, why kids They eat pretty much everything the adults do by the time they're in kindergarten. And food and meal time is just treated as a joyful and sociable event during the day.
You know, that's funny. Every place has its advantages and disadvantages. I lived in the south of France for 4 years in the 90s, and it was an incredible time. And I did see how children are raised with an appreciation for all foods.
Yeah.
And that whining, that I don't like this, I don't like that, is just not tolerated.
It's not. And it seems like they don't make a big deal if the kid doesn't want to taste it. They just whisk it away and say, you'll try it again another time. But there are no other options given as well. There aren't alternatives or, you know, special kid food made.
On the other hand, they didn't put out a crazy law last year where meat or animal products have to be served or like mandatory protein in the school lunch program.
That is true. That's unbelievable. I think unbelievable.
Yeah, so they've got some work to do, as we all do.
Yeah.
We can all learn from everybody else. So you probably heard that here in Queens, New York, in Flushing, New York, we have the first elementary school, the first school, public school, that serves all vegetarian lunches.
I did hear that. Fantastic.
It is fantastic. They might enjoy your books.
I was thinking the same thing.
Or they might enjoy having you come and chat with them, because that seems like, I think every school is perfect for every elementary school, but at least that would be a very receptive audience.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to get into schools in general because the rule in general is that they can't officially endorse, quote-unquote, any one diet, even though, of course, they do.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and it's a really great lesson to see, you know, how much the parents had a hand in that and how the community came together on this issue. And I think it's really smart. I think we're going to see more and more of it.
Now, I just realized this, but last week I had a guy on the show, Rob Poe, who goes by the name of Broccoli Rob, and he has a musical program to encourage kids to eat vegetables. And he's a vegan, but he doesn't push the vegan thing. He just pushes the vegetable thing. And I think it's like you said, because the schools cannot endorse one particular diet.
Yeah.
Right, but who knows? Maybe Broccoli Rob needs to meet Ruby Roth and do some sort of musical, artistic, vegan promotion
thing. Yeah.
I'm all about networking and connecting the dots here, but we definitely need to do more for kids.
Yeah, and it's such a great international community, the vegan and vegetarian population.
It is. We are family,
mm-hmm.
or vamily, or something like that. Yeah. We just have a few minutes left. You know, I'm constantly surprised, dismayed with stuff that comes out in science, and this isn't necessarily kid-related, but I just wanted to talk about it. I was just reading some studies have been done with farmed fish, where they're discovering there's all kinds of problems with farmed fish,
mm-hmm.
with the fish getting sick and having all kinds of illnesses and filth around them, and plus it's not environmentally sustainable, because we take all of this sea life, these sea animals, from the oceans to feed the fish that are being farmed. So it's not like we're not touching the oceans, because
right.
we are. We're totally depleting them. So this study came out and said that these farmed animals do better on a plant-based diet. And rather than feeding them fish, it would be really good to feed them plant-based diet. And I'm thinking, come on, can't you? Wait a minute. You're missing the whole point. Can we just eliminate the whole fish scene? Don't you realize humans do better on a plant-based diet?
Yeah, I mean, skip the middle man.
Exactly, or somebody, who was it who said, skip the middle meat?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we just need to eat more of what the fish in the ocean are eating.
Right. Now, is there a fish in here in your book?
I cover it in use and reuse. Please don't waste. As the oceans are in there, but yes, in other two books, I definitely cover the oceans and fish, and their emotions and sensitivities.
Yeah, well, a lot of people overlook fish because they're so different. I mean, we can sort of relate to mammals, and yet we treat them horribly. But fish are even beyond what most of us can imagine as thinking and feeling. But we know that they do.
And I think it's really important that people check out the footage of mass commercial fishing boats and what that looks like, because that is really impactful to see the just mass quantity that we're pulling out of the ocean. And I think that visual hits you on a gut level, and you can feel as your human instincts that is not right.
Oh, just how these trawlers go and scoop literally everything up for miles, and they don't even use everything that they're scooping up.
Oh, it is so wasteful.
It is obscene.
To see that, you can visually see that the fish are suffering. I mean, speaking of purposeless scientific studies, I mean, we don't need rocket science to see this. We just need to see it. To feel and to see that it's wrong. We've made such a mass mistake on this way of living and this way of eating.
I'm on your website, WeDon'tEatAnimals.com, and you have a blog. And I just wanted to talk about a few things that I read there. I loved your most recent post about where the wild things are,
yeah,
by Maurice Sendak, and how you were referenced in an article about him.
And yes, pitted against him.
I know, but so funny how people don't even know what they're talking about. Hello.
They really don't. Maurice Sendak was a very dark and complicated individual, and he believed wholeheartedly in telling kids the truth. And the journalist that pitted me against him, saying, you know, they was very sentimental about those kind of picture books from the past that weren't so, quote-unquote, politically correct and left politics out. But if you look at Maurice Sendak's work and his beliefs, we're actually more similar than we are different.
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned it. I remember watching the movie Where the Wild Things Are, and I had very different feelings about it because there were some very troubling, dark images in them, but
yes, some of them. That book was actually banned by some librarians when
mm-hmm.
it first came out for being too disturbing and dark, which is, you know, quite familiar to me. Familiar.
Okay, another post. You posted this this video with little Antonio, which kind of went viral a few months ago.
Yeah.
I don't know. I saw the video. I don't know anything about it, but it was incredible.
Yeah. I mean, you get to witness the moment that a child realizes that he's eating animals. And somehow this was caught on tape with a mother and a son's interaction with one another, and he had quite an impact on his mom. You can see the wheels turning, and you can see the revelation. It's pretty amazing.
I'm just amazed that they caught it on camera, and even if they planned it, this child is so young and so full of wisdom and just quiet, calm peace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes kids so capable. Much more capable than society gives them credit for, is their understanding of the world around them. And I just think it's time, you know, leaders and industry leaders across the board are saying that we're lacking critical thinkers and people with passion and drive in all sectors of industry. And I think that one of the greatest benefits of veganism, as we talked about this whole half hour, is the benefits beyond just the animals and the health. So I think veg education gives you those things. It takes some grit, it takes passion and caring and empathy. And
a lot of courage.
A lot of courage to stand up for what you believe in, even when you're the only one. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a solution on many levels for us as a society.
Well, that says it all. Thank you, Ruby Roth, for joining me on It's All About Food. I'm a big fan of your books. Keep writing.
Thank you again for having me.
Okay.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Bye.
And her website is wedonteatanimals.com. Shall we take a break? And when we come back, we're going to talk with Brian Patton, the sexy vegan. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And here we are. It's already part two of today's program, August 13, 2013. Gosh, time really flies when I'm talking about my favorite subject, food. It just goes like that. It's almost as good as eating it. And I'm going to bring on my next guest, Brian Patton, the sexy vegan. He's the author of The Sexy Vegan's Happy Hour at Home and The Sexy Vegan Cookbook. He's also the executive chef for Veggin' Out, a vegan food delivery service in Los Angeles. As the quintessential, quote, regular dude vegan chef, he started posting instructional cooking videos on YouTube as his witty ukulele playing alter ego, The Sexy Vegan, and quickly gained a large following. Visit him online at thesexyvegan.com. But before you go there, let's listen right now because I'm going to bring Brian on. Hi, how you doing, Brian? Welcome to the
show. Oh, here I am. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Well, I think we're on a very similar mission, which is to make plant-based food fun and delicious.
I would agree. That is my mission indeed.
Yes, so I was happy to discover you. And there was a time in my life, I've been vegan over 25 years, and there was a time when I thought I knew all the vegans out there. And now it seems like I'm learning about a gazillion of them every day, which is really...
We're multiplying exponentially.
Yes, and, you know, I have nothing... I'm not procreating, so it's not like I'm making any, but...
right.
Somehow they are multiplying.
Yes, they are.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful, delicious thing.
I agree.
All right, so shall we talk to Brian, or shall we talk to your alter ego, the sexy guy?
Your choice. Mostly the same guy. One is just a little bit more exaggerated and annoying. So,
okay, let's hold off on the annoying part, and let's just jump right in. So, no. Before we jump right in, I was trying to learn a little bit more about you, and I wanted to know about your past because I couldn't find it anywhere.
Well, I'm very mysterious that way.
Yes.
So I try to keep things very under wraps.
I know you're from Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, I am from Pennsylvania. I'm from, like, the Pocono area, northeastern PA. You know, kind of rural, kind of, you know, not a place where a vegan would really live very well at this time, probably. You know, grew up sort of eating just pizza and more pizza and stromboli and pierogies and whatever else was the local fare. I come from, my part of town was very, you know, it was Irish and Italian mostly, so there was a lot of that type of food. So, grew up having these huge, like, Sunday dinners over at my grandparents' house, homemade pasta, meatballs, you know, homemade bread, everything. I don't know what time they woke up in the morning to make this, but it was pretty insane that they fed like 16 people by noon with this everything made from scratch meal.
Yeah,
so,
amen to that.
So it was quite great, you know, to have that as part of my childhood for sure. So maybe that's where I got my little kind of spark for cooking.
Right. Well, I'm from New York, and I've lived all around the world, and I did go to college in Pennsylvania at Bucknell University. And
I went to Susquehanna University,
well,
right
I was
down the road.
I had a feeling.
Arch rivals.
It was the Stromboli page in your book that kind of got me curious, because when I was going to Bucknell, I had a rock band, and my senior year, my band was at Penn State. And there was some amazing Stromboli in State College, Pennsylvania, where Penn State University was amazing.
Yes, there's a place right downtown State College. I think it's called Highway Pizza. I'm not sure if it's still there or not, but I think that's what it was called, and that's the go-to place.
Right, and I have to admit that I have kind of been stromboli-free for the last quarter century just because it's not an easy thing to come by vegan-wise.
No, not in Los Angeles for sure. When I moved here 10 years ago, I got all these pizza menus dropped off on my doorstep, and I was like, oh, I'll order a stromboli. And there was no stromboli, so I called and asked, and they said they didn't know what that was. So, and I find that weird because there's so many, I had to figure that there's at least one person who moved from the East Coast to the West Coast and opened a pizza place and put a stromboli on the menu, but I have yet to find that in 10 years of living here.
And you know, how hard is it? Stromboli's just like a rolled-up pizza.
It's a tube of pizza. It's very easy, a very simple concept. Maybe they feel that,
I don't know,
that
and in this
Californians would be scared of that or something. I don't know.
Well,
I don't know. Because,
you know,
the East Coast is used to tubes. You know, they're used to subways and things and clothes and things, and we don't have that out here. So maybe that's the reason. I'm just guessing.
I don't know. But, you know, we've got the burrito is quite popular. It's not.
That is a good point.
And I've seen some pretty giant burritos that are almost as big as a stromboli, not quite, but
yes,
almost.
You are correct. I
so
have
maybe
seen
the,
that too. So
maybe the stromboli is
I think
is
you
the
just
name.
Shot down my whole tube argument.
There you go. Crash on the tube. Anyway, yeah. So the holy stromboli is the first entry in your happy hour at home book.
Yeah. That's correct.
And why don't you just back up a little bit now that I've already jumped into the book. What is this Happy Hour at Home book?
Okay. Happy Hour basically started as sort of a whim. I came home one, it was like Friday night, and my pantry and my fridge were basically barren because, you know, it's the end of the week and I do my shopping and stuff on Saturday, so I didn't have much to deal with. The girlfriend was coming over, was coming home, who has since become the wife, and she I didn't have, you know, I usually do all the cooking, so I didn't have anything to make a major meal, so I just took a can of beans and a couple whatever was left in the crisper and some grains and just put together these kind of small plates. They sort of didn't really make sense all that much at the time, but they were just these like little small plates, and we sat out on our little balcony and drank some adult beverages, and that was, you know, sort of happy how it began. And so I thought, oh, this is kind of nice. We have these small plates. It's almost like tapas type thing, but we don't have to go out to a bar and get crappy food and pay for drinks and deal with a bunch of people. We just got to do it in the comfort of our own home. So I thought, hey, let me do this every week. So every Friday, I started doing the same thing. I would just grab random things, put them together. Sometimes things were good, sometimes they weren't good, but I was just like, I was just, you know, shooting from the hip basically, and that was sort of fun. So what happened then is it sort of, my wife started like bragging to her friends about this thing that we were doing, and then they were wondering where their invitation was. So,
because they certainly weren't going to cook at home.
Romantic, nice thing for just her and I, became more of a job for me now, because now I have to feed more people, and I got to plan it out a little bit more, because, you know, these people are coming over this Friday, and these people are coming over next Friday, so that was sort of how it all, that's where the happy hour idea came from. And so that's what's in the book, is just different menus, and the menus all kind of go, you know, one, you know, the holy stromboli, for instance, it has a stromboli, and then it has some quick jardinera, which is sort of like a quick pickled vegetable dish, and then these like little cannoli cups as sort of a dessert. So that would be an example of a happy hour menu that I would do, before this book came to be.
Do people invite you over and make food for you?
No. Never.
Can we talk about that a little bit?
Everybody comes here.
Yeah.
I'm always doing the work.
I know. Now,
absolutely.
Why is that? You know, we cook a lot here, and we love cooking, and we're real creative about it, and we love having parties and having people over. And yet, is it because, well, I think it's a number of things. I think because most people don't know where their kitchen is.
This is true. This is very true.
They don't want to make, and then if they're not vegan, it just scares them. What are we going to make? They're vegan.
What are we going to feed this guy? Absolutely. Like, you know, the few times where there's like, you know, if there's a party that I'm going to or something like that, you know, people get really freaked out. They're like, oh, well, look, you know, because of my friends, I'm pretty much the only vegan or vegetarian of, you know, of our friends, aside from my wife, who's pescatarian. But she you know, people like kind of freak out. They're like, well, we'll make sure we have something for him. You know, what can we have? Where should we get it? What should we do? What is he like? And, you know, I'm just like, I'll bring something. It's fine. It's easy for me to bring something. Don't stress. But people get very stressed out. And believe me, I appreciate that. It's a very excellent, nice gesture. But yeah, I do see that happening a lot.
Yeah, so the message is, for those of you who want to invite us, don't stress out.
Don't stress out, because we are professionals. We are professional vegans. We, after being vegan for a certain amount of time, you know how to operate in the world as a vegan. You know that if you go into a restaurant, you do research ahead of time, you find out what's on the menu, maybe you can make something like that. You know, that's another thing. If we're going out to eat, somebody will suggest a restaurant to be like, oh, I don't know if there's anything there for you. I'm like, don't worry, I will find something on the menu. There's always a vegetable side dish. There's always a salad that I can take cheese and meat out of. You know, so.
But it's also good,
need
a good opportunity.
Remain calm.
Yeah, remain
and,
calm.
Don't worry about it.
But it's also a good opportunity to open a cookbook like Happy Hour at Home and see if there's something that sounds good to you and try and make it, because you'll only be a better person.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it'll just open your mind a little bit if you do cook in the kitchen but you don't cook vegan. You know, seeing how easy things can be, how quick they can come together, and how good they can taste, you know, without any animal products is something everybody should really experience, because it's really not that hard. And that's why I do the books that I do.
I wanted to say a few things. I can't say them all at once, so I'll just take a deep breath. I don't know if I remember them as we go along. I learned to cook from cookbooks and just from trial and error and looking at dishes. I lived in France for 4 years as a vegan, and I just looked at what other people were eating and thought, okay, whatever that is, I'm going to try and make it. And you learn that way. So for people that aren't comfortable in the kitchen and don't know how to cook, you just have to start. You just have to try something. So what if you fail? You try again.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. You have to be aware that you will fail. You will spend an hour and a half cooking something, and you'll burn it, you'll do something wrong, and you'll have to throw it away. It happens to everyone. It happens to me sometimes now. Like, it's just a fact of life. That will happen. So you have to be prepared for that and not give up when that happens. So I say start simply. Go find a vegetable that you've never eaten before, that you've never prepared before, and, you know, use that for a week. You can try different recipes with just that simple ingredient, like a kale or some sort of grain that you've never heard of before. Just try it and learn how to make that. And then next week, you know, pick something else and just tackle things slowly and slowly take an interest in the food that you're making.
Yes, definitely. It's so worth it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So worth it. The other thing that I wanted to mention was somewhere in the beginning of the book, I think, you talk about efficiency and managing and why some people don't succeed in the kitchen is because they're not planning, and how important that is.
Yeah, I mean, that is really very important when you're in the kitchen, especially if you're preparing a couple different dishes, you know, a main dish and two side dishes or something like that. You really have to use there's always going to be these pockets of time. So you don't have to chop up every single thing in the recipe, in all of the recipes at the same time. Because one thing you might have to chop up and put in the oven for an hour. So you do that first, put it in the oven, and then go back to chopping the other stuff. So what I've done in the book is at the beginning of the chapters are a menu. So each menu is like three, sometimes four dishes. So at the beginning of each menu, I have this efficiency tip that tells you when to do things across the three recipes. So you might do one thing for one recipe first, then skip to the second recipe because this will take this amount of time, and you utilize that pocket of time. So it tells you how to make these menus most efficiently, and hopefully the idea is that the reader would take that skill from just these recipes and be able to apply that to cooking out of any other cookbooks or any recipes from online.
Okay, now everybody that's listening right now, I know you're online. So if you go to thesexyvegan.com/gallery,
yes,
you'll be able to get a sampling of what things look like that are in this book.
Yeah,
right?
It's a full color photo gallery on the website. It's the same photos plus some more that are in the book. That's just a quick way to go see them online, you know, before you buy the book. You can get some great full-color, beautiful pics of what types of dishes that you'll be finding here.
The one that makes me laugh the most is this, I don't know what you call it, but this spinach dip in the bread thing.
The spinach artichoke dip in the bread bowl.
Yes. Okay, now I'm sure this is like light years ahead of in flavor and quality and nutritional value than what was served. I don't know when these spinach dips and bread bowls came out. Was that like a 70s or 80s thing?
I think maybe, yeah. I don't know. I didn't become alive until 1978, so I don't remember the 70s really.
Oh, gosh, I do. And these were quite the popular thing, but this one looks just so much better. The bread looks better.
Totally. It's a recreation of a dish that there's a place in Sealands Grove, actually, which you should, a town you should be familiar with.
Yeah, I bought my first car there. Oh, no, Susquehanna, not Sealings. No, Sealings Grove, Toyota, I think it was. Anyway, tell me more about Sealings Grove.
So anyway, there's a place called BJ's that we used to go to, and they had this, it's called Bongo Bongo Dip, and it was just this, like, bubbly, cheesy spinach artichoke dip with all kinds of cheeses, and it also had water chestnuts, which I hate, but I would just eat around those. So I wanted to recreate that dish because I just loved it so much, and who doesn't love a good spinach artichoke dip? So this one's mainly cashew-based, and it's super easy to make. You blend up some cashews and some spices, spinach and artichokes, and you're good to go. And, if you got a bread bowl standing by from 1972, good for you.
Very good. Now, I read that you became a vegan after working at Veg-In in Los Angeles.
Right. Veg-In Out is the name of the company. I'm executive chef there now. And we're a food delivery service, so we deliver a full week's worth of fully prepared meals to people in Los Angeles and Southern California.
Who don't know where their kitchens are. Yeah.
What's that?
For people who don't know where their kitchens are.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I started working there just as sort of a prep cook. I was also doing marketing, but I was basically chopping vegetables, helping with the preparation of the food. I was really unhealthy. I would probably weigh about 260 pounds. Mm. I had a lot of bad habits, like lots of alcohol and cigarettes and all this horrible stuff. Mm. And I thought, okay, I'm working for this vegan company. I'm sick of what I look like and how I feel and all the things that I'm doing. So I'll try being vegan for a month. I'm around this food. I'm learning about how to cook it. I have access to it. So I'll be vegan for a month and see what happens. So a month went by. I started to feel better. I lost a couple pounds. I thought, that wasn't that hard. Let me see if I can do another month. So that led to, 10 months down the road, I am 60 pounds lighter, and I just feel like I did when I was, like, 18 again. So from that point, I was like, that's it. I'm vegan now. I don't need to consume, I don't need to harm another being in order to survive and thrive and feel great. I made that connection.
Very good. I love stories like that. Now, let me ask you, does it extend to beyond food, your vegan philosophy?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I definitely didn't become vegan for the ethical types of reasons. I just did it for health reasons. I didn't really make a connection with the ethical reasons until probably right around that 10 month to a year mark. By nature of being vegan and looking up vegan recipes and vegan items, you can't help but come across the ethical, you know, videos about slaughterhouses and all this sort of information. I listen to Colleen Patrick Goudreau's podcast a lot, Vegetarian Food for Thought, during my transition, and in that first year, and that's when I really sort of got hip to all that information, along with doing my own research. So, there was a point at which I was like sitting when I really realized that I was vegan for more than just health. Was about after about a year, I was sitting on my couch and a spider was walking across my floor. And 10 times out of 10 before that, I would just stomp on the spider, stomp it out of existence, and go about my day and not care about it. But for some reason, at that moment, I just, without thinking, I got like, you know, I got a cup and a piece of paper and I trapped it and I like scooped it up and I escorted it outside. And at that moment, my roommate walked into the room, and he was like, what are you doing? Why? What did you just do? I said, I have no idea why I just did that, but I guess, like, I don't kill spiders anymore. And so I sat down, and I thought about why did I do that, and I just realized that I realized the connection that I had with the spider, and that the spider was just going about its day. It didn't know that it was, like, on my turf and scaring me and creeping me out. He didn't know that. He was just being a spider. So I think, in the grand scheme of the universe, us humans, we don't know what we are. Maybe we're just a spider that hasn't gotten stepped on yet. So I put that on the spider. I'm like, okay, well, the spider hasn't attacked me in any way, so I'm just going to let him go about his day as I go about my day, not attacking people. So
the power of being mindful.
Exactly, and I had never made that connection until that moment.
Yeah.
And then from then on, I was like, okay, like, no more leather in my shoes, no more leather belts, no more...
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because it looks in your pictures that you you have a little fashion sense. Where are you getting your men's clothing?
I get the Alternative Outfitters is a place that, you know, that's where I would get, like, my belts and, shoes, also Moo Shoes, I think is the name of a company.
Oh, yeah, they're in New York City, right here.
Yeah, so those are great places to get, you know, leather-free items. And the tie, if you see, I'm wearing a bow tie. Bow ties especially are made from silk.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not all vegan place, but it's called the Tie Bar. And it's really cheap ties, you know, $15. They have a whole section that's just cotton ties that aren't made from any animal products.
Mm.
And, they're like $15, and they have great, lots of killer designs. I swear by them for the ties. So it's so easy, you know, to find clothes that are not animal derived that there's no point in not getting it. Maybe it's a little more expensive, but maybe oftentimes it's not. It's worth it.
Right. Okay, one other question. Yeah. Where does the ukulele fit into all of this?
I've been playing guitar for, you know, since college, and I don't even know where I saw somebody playing a ukulele, or I heard, a friend of mine had a ukulele, and they brought it to a party. I was like, let me see that thing. So I started, like, messing around with it. I was like, I like the sound of this. So I started to learn it, and I just started to write, like, silly little goofy songs. I have a song about pizza. I have a song called Seriously, You Shouldn't Eat Meat. I have a song called The Bacon on a Ukulele Song. I have a song called Artichokes, You're One of a Kind. So I write little songs about food. And you can see all those on my YouTube page. If you just go to thesexyvegan.com, you'll see all the links to YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all that stuff where you'll find me.
Very good. I love it. I think it's really important to spread the word with music. It's something that we're doing at my nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, we've created recently, the Swingin' Gourmets.
Oh, yes, I know that.
Yes, and so that's all about swinging great music and food, and we need...
Yeah, but you all sing way better than I do. I'm horrible.
Thank you very much. Well, we try. Yeah. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining me on the Talk About Food. I hope maybe sometime you're in New York, I'll have you over. I'm not afraid to cook for you.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm up for the challenge of letting you cook for me.
Great. Well, you'll have to let me know.
Thank you so very much.
Okay. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. All right, just a minute left. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. It's All About Food. It's All About Food. And I just wanted to let you know a number of things. Now, my website is responsibleeatingandliving.com. And you may remember a few years ago I interviewed Courtney Mader of Pure Water. They've got some great water distillers. And what I loved about them is they're made in the United States. Well, now, if you want to find them, you can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and click on the Water Made Wonderful link and find out about these water distillers. With called Aquany. I think they're a really great product, and so I'm happy to be affiliated with them. And then, of course, the Swing Gourmets will be coming out with the part two of our Real American Barbecue, and if you haven't seen the first episode yet, please check it out at swinggourmets.com. There we go. That's the end of the hour. Thank you so much for joining me. I've had fun. I hope you have. And remember, you can email me at info@realmeals.org, right? And what else? Have a delicious week.